Welcome to the Be Freed podcast, where we distill the world's best sources, books, talks, and research into personalized insights you can actually finish. I'm Naya.
And I'm Jackson. Today we're diving into a topic that affects millions but often hides in plain sight, the complex relationship between healthy eating and eating disorders like anorexia, bulimia, and binge eating.
You know, it's fascinating how blurry that line can be. One day, you're trying to eat clean, and before you know it, you're in this tug-of-war with food that feels impossible to win.
Exactly. And we're going to connect dots between clinical research, neuroscience from sources like the Huberman Lab podcast, and lived experiences to help navigate this terrain. Because eating well shouldn't mean living in fear of food.
So, Jackson, let's start with some context. How common are eating disorders really?
More common than most people realize. Binge eating disorder is actually the most prevalent eating disorder in the U.S., while anorexia has the highest mortality rate of any psychiatric disorder, about 5.86 times higher than the general population, according to that 2011 meta-analysis in JAMA Psychiatry.
That's sobering. And these aren't just extreme cases we're talking about, right? There's this whole spectrum between normal eating and diagnosable disorders.
Right. The National Institute of Mental Health emphasizes that eating disorders aren't lifestyle choices. They're serious mental illnesses with real medical consequences. And they can affect anyone, regardless of gender, age, or body size.
I've definitely experienced that pressure to eat perfectly. It's exhausting. What does healthy eating even mean anymore?
That's such a good question. The boring but true foundation is still what the dietary guidelines suggest. Build meals around nutrient-dense foods, enjoy variety, respect cultural traditions. Healthy eating becomes unhealthy when it's rigid, isolating, or driven by shame.
I've always wondered, why is it so hard to just eat normally? Like, sometimes I'm not even hungry, but can't stop eating certain foods.
That's where the neuroscience gets fascinating. Our eating is governed by two complementary systems, the homeostatic system, basically your body's fuel gauge with hormones like leptin and ghrelin signaling energy needs, and the hedonic system, which is all about pleasure and reward.
So it's like having both a practical accountant and a pleasure-seeking party animal in your brain making food decisions?
Exactly. And when food is engineered to be hyper-palatable and convenient, that hedonic drive can overpower our homeostatic signals, especially when we're stressed or sleep-deprived. That Stanford research from 2023 even tied binge eating to specific habit circuits in the brain's putamen region.
I heard about that fascinating study, where people ate about 500 calories more per day on ultra-processed diets compared to unprocessed ones, even when they were matched for nutrients and sugar.
Yes, that Hall study was eye-opening. It suggests the processing itself, soft textures, rapid eating, calorie density, drives intake beyond willpower. It's not just about self-control. Our food environment is literally designed to override our natural satiety signals.
Naya read in a relatable, casual, empathetic voice, like a best friend who just gets you.
Oh my gosh, yes. The whole clean eating Monday through Friday, then weekend blowout cycle. It's like the more I restrict, the more I eventually rebel.
Neuroscientist Sandra Ayama explains this perfectly in her TED Talk. Chronic dieting can actually push your brain to defend a higher set point, amplifying hunger and slowing metabolism. Her message is about living sanely with food, focusing on habits and mindful cues rather than rigid rules.
I love her quote, "Our daughters have learned to measure their worth by a wrong scale." That hits hard.
And social media makes it worse. That 2025 meta-analysis of 83 studies found it's not just screen time that matters, but the content, weight loss, and appearance-focused feeds correlate with more eating disorder symptoms.
So we should curate our feeds like our pantries. That makes so much sense. So if someone is struggling, what actually works? There's so much conflicting advice out there.
Clinical guidelines from the American Psychiatric Association and NICE in the UK point to several evidence-based treatments. For adults across different eating disorders, CBTE, Enhanced Cognitive Behavioral Therapy, is often the first-line psychotherapy. It targets the overvaluation of weight and shape, rigid rules, and unhelpful habits.
And for teenagers with anorexia, isn't there a family-based approach that's shown good results?
Yes, family-based treatment, sometimes called the Maudsley approach, empowers parents to help restore nutrition. It has strong evidence outperforming individual therapies for many teens.
What about medications? I know they're not the whole solution, but do they help?
They can be part of comprehensive care. For binge eating disorder, lisdaxamfetamine, Vyvanse, is FDA approved for adults and shows reduced binge days in trials. For bulimia, SSRIs, particularly fluoxetine at higher doses, have evidence for reducing binge/purge frequency. For anorexia, no medication treats the condition fully, but olanzapine has modest evidence for helping adult outpatients gain weight.
And I imagine medical monitoring is crucial too.
Absolutely non-negotiable. All eating disorders can produce dangerous electrolyte shifts, cardiac issues, bone loss. These are medical emergencies requiring proper care.
Naya read in a relatable, casual, empathetic voice, like a best friend who just gets you.
I found that creating a food environment that makes the default easy helps tremendously, like having satisfying meals and snacks ready when I need them.
That's brilliant. The Hall study supports that approach. Emphasizing minimally processed staples when possible helps your homeostatic signals function better. And slowing down your eating rate, especially with those hyperpalatable foods, gives satiety signals time to catch up.
I've also noticed that when I have some structure, regular meals, and planned snacks, I'm less likely to get ravenously hungry and then overeat later.
That's actually a therapeutic tool in CBTE. It's about creating guardrails, not chains. You're not micromanaging, you're preventing those extreme hunger swings that trigger binges.
And watching for those diet rules that become part of your identity seems important too. If you can't break a rule, like no carbs after 6 p.m., the rule owns you.
Exactly. Both Amott's talk and the intuitive eating approach emphasize internal cues over external dogma. Ironically, this often leads to more balanced choices long term.
What if you're worried about someone else? How can you help without making things worse?
Great question. First, avoid comments about appearance. Even well-intentioned ones like, "but you look fine," can be harmful. Instead, express concern about specific behaviors and offer to help them find support.
So something like, "I care about you. I've noticed you seem stressed around food. I'm here to listen and help you find support."
Perfect. And definitely avoid casual diet advice or suggesting they try the latest trend. NIHM emphasizes that eating disorders can affect anyone, any age, gender, or body size, so assumptions based on appearance are often wrong.
What about athletes? They face unique pressures around food and body image, right?
Absolutely. The International Olympic Committee has addressed this with their concept of REDS, relative energy deficiency in sport, when athletes don't consume enough calories to support their training. It affects hormones, bone health, and performance. If performance or mood worsens while training increases, that's a red flag to check for disordered eating patterns.
Despite those sobering statistics, there is hope, right?
Definitely. Treatment options have expanded significantly. We've sharpened psychotherapies like CBTE, family treatments have evolved, and we have more options for conditions like binge eating disorder. The key is combining compassionate, skilled therapy with medical monitoring and creating a food environment that supports, not sabotages, recovery.
I think what's most powerful is the idea that you can nourish yourself well without making nourishment your entire identity.
That's it exactly. The science and lived experience of millions suggest a path that protects both physical and mental health. More structure, less perfectionism, more support, less secrecy, more compassion, fewer rules.
So if we had to distill this down to a few takeaways people could act on this week, what would they be?
First, build guardrails, not chains. Use regular meals and satisfying snacks to prevent those hangry swings that trigger binges.
Second, nudge your environment. Keep minimally processed, protein-forward options visible and ready and slow down during the first 5 minutes of each meal.
Third, audit your social media feeds. Unfollow comparison-heavy accounts and follow creators who model flexible, joyful eating instead.
And finally, if you're concerned about yourself or someone else, don't wait. Ask for an ED-informed assessment and bring those APA or NICE recommendations to your visit.
Exactly. You can eat well without obsession. You can care about nutrition without it becoming your religion. And if you're struggling, there's help available.
That's your daily dose of smarter from the Be Freed podcast. I'm Naya.
And I'm Jackson. Remember, your relationship with food should nourish your life, not consume it. See you next time.